Good afternoon and welcome to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and I'm joined today by co-host and legal expert Judge Elaine Andrews. Our topic today is juries, and there's a lot to talk about. What's the difference between a grand jury and a trial jury? Who serves on a jury? What is the job of the jury? Is this a universal element of justice, or is it unique to the United States? And what about the individual juror? How do they get called to serve? How do you know if you're even qualified? Can you refuse? What if you make a mistake? And then there's the art and science of actually selecting a jury. How do defense attorneys and prosecutors think about jurors when they ask them questions? How should you feel if you aren't selected to serve? Before we get to our guests, let me point out that we have useful resources on our website, including two short videos on jury service, one for serving on a trial jury and one for serving on a grand jury. Find those at alaskapublic.org under Hometown Alaska. Finally, if you've served on a jury or have a question about the process, please join this conversation. Your questions and comments are always welcome. You can give us a call at 550-8433 in Anchorage, or around the state, it's 1-888-353-5752, or we'll take an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So now to our two guests. Judge Andrews, will you introduce them and get us going?
So today we have Stacey Warby, who is the statewide jury coordinator, and Ray Brown, a longtime Alaska lawyer with a deep experience in jury trials and picks juries as a trial lawyer. And so I'd kind of like to start with Stacey, because she's the one who gets the jurors to the courthouse. And to tell us a little bit about what your job as a statewide jury coordinator consists of, and tell us a little bit about how jurors get to both urban and rural courtrooms.
Sure. Well, our role as a state jury office is we help facilitate the local courts to get the jurors to the courtrooms. We don't actually call the jurors. We rely on each of the courts to do that. But we manage the jury management system, which is JuryView, and we make sure all the courts have all the mailings that they need to get the court, the jurors into the courtroom.
And my understanding is that things have evolved over time, and it used to be that you would get your little jury card,
right,
and then you would have to send back this written jury questionnaire, and then you would get another card in the mail later, and you'd have a number, and you'd have to call in. And can you tell us what are the mechanics of how a person might learn that they've been selected to come to the courthouse to serve as a juror?
We're a little more technologically advanced now. You can go online and fill out a jury questionnaire. There, initially, you'll receive a postcard in the mail that says you have jury service. So you can go online and fill out a questionnaire and get all your call-in information right there. You can even sign up in most courts for a text message reminder to remind you that you do have jury service. So we're working on
getting. Is that true in Anchorage?
It's true in Anchorage. Most of the larger courts and all grand jury courts will give you a reminder if you request it on your cell phone. And the questionnaire online you can even fill out on your cell phone, so you don't even need to have a personal computer for that.
Hmm. Okay. Well, you mentioned grand juries, so I think that one of the things we should maybe just kind of talk about for a second and then move it away, because I think today we want to focus on trial juries, and but people hear the word grand jury, and sometimes they think that's a big case as opposed to a little jury.
Like, right. They do call trial juries petty juries.
Yeah,
right?
Petty
right.
juries.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Right.
So, can you explain from your point of view as the statewide jury coordinator what the grand jury is, and,
sure,
and what a trial juror?
The grand jury's role is quite different from the trial jury. The grand jury looks at whether a case should be brought to trial based on the evidence presented by the district attorney. So they're not deciding guilt or innocence. They're just deciding if there's enough evidence to bring it to trial. And the trial jury's role is to listen to all the evidence presented in court and determine what the facts are.
Okay. So if you were selected for grand jury,
mm-hmm,
How does that service look different in terms of time commitment?
A grand juror serves quite a bit differently than a trial juror. They know what days they're going to be coming in, and generally they know the schedule. And it varies widely throughout the state. There are 12 grand jury courts. Say in Anchorage, they serve a 3-month term for 1 week on and 3 weeks off for that term. So they serve either 3 or 4 weeks, and they do come in 4 days a week.
Do they actually go into a courtroom or do they go into a conference room?
In Anchorage, they have an actual grand jury courtroom. So it's specifically for grand jury. It's set up just for the grand jurors to sit out and the DA to present evidence. There's only one court employee there, the in-court clerk, who facilitates.
So a judge doesn't go to the grand jury?
No, not at all.
Hmm. Okay. And then the people who are called in to serve for trial juries, mm-hmm. What's the time expectation for those folks?
And that, again, widely varies throughout the state. In Anchorage, you're on call for 1 week. Some of the smaller courts are on call for the entire year. So Palmer recently moved from a one-month term to a two-week term, so that's a boon for the jurors out in Palmer. So they only need to call in for 2 weeks now instead of a full month. Some other courts, there's three-month terms, four-month terms. It just depends on the needs of the trials and the population size, really.
And so people often wonder how did they find my name?
Right.
Why am I being called? Where do you get
we
the
get
names?
All our information is exclusively from the permanent fund. So if you apply for the permanent fund, we receive your name. And it's not if you receive a permanent fund, it's if you applied at all. So if you apply for the permanent fund and give a home address in Alaska, you are on our list the next year.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You and I were chatting before the before the program started about the fact that if you apply for your permanent fund and you come to court and you want to persuade the judge you shouldn't be serving, and you say things like, well, I'm only here this month and then I'm gone to Hawaii for the rest of the year, all of his statements are on a public record, and that information gets reported back to the PFD office.
Right,
yes.
Right. It's a two-way communication.
It's a two-way communication.
We help them out.
Yes, yes. So what kind of money does the state spend to bring jurors to the courthouse and make them available for trial?
In the 2017 fiscal year, and for the court that runs July 1st of 2016 to June 30th of 2017, we spent $1.2 million statewide to bring jurors to the court. And that includes the pay. And for jurors, that's $25 per day, beginning with the second day of service. It includes travel in the courts that we provide travel for, lodging and jury meals. If you are deliberating, the court pays for a lunch for you.
You know, what districts will they fly people in to serve on a jury? Is that rural Alaska primarily?
Rural Alaska, and it's not too many courts. Bethel, Naknek, Monick, Aniak, Kodiak.
And I guess that would include housing them then when they're,
right.
Mm-hmm. When they're, so I can see how the expenses could run up.
They do. Mm-hmm.
So we were talking before the program started too, how many jurors you would call into Anchorage over the year, mm-hmm. and how much that would cost, and how many you call in for Bethel and how much that costs. I think
right.
It's a pretty interesting comparison.
It's an interesting set of numbers. And Anchorage, we had 9,000 jurors appear for service in fiscal year 2017, and we spent about $325,000 to do that. And in Anchorage, we don't usually pay for mileage or lodging or anything like that. So that is pretty much straight jury fees and jury meals. And in Bethel, we didn't call quite as many jurors. We called about 1,300 jurors, and it's about the same amount of money because about half of the jurors come from villages. We have to fly them in and pay for their housing and
wow.
meals while they're there.
Right.
That's complicated.
Well, you are entitled to a jury of your peers.
Absolutely.
And the Alaska Supreme Court has taken that quite seriously and said, you know, people are entitled to both urban and village dwelling citizens. And so our juries have to reflect our reality. So to that extent, we spend a great deal of money trying to meet that constitutional bar. So, Ray, we have you here. Have you had the experience of trying cases out in a rural village or a rural area in Alaska and experienced this business of jurors coming in and having to select jurors in unusual locations?
Well, you know, curiously enough, I have not tried any cases north of Fairbanks, so I guess the answer is no. So most of the cases I've tried have been in southeast Alaska and south central Alaska, but never really north of Fairbanks.
A wise man.
I have a question. You know, the idea is you're going to be judged by a jury of your peers, but sometimes cases are removed from one geographic area because somebody, I don't know who, makes the case that we can't get a jury that is. So I guess I'm just asking, when does that happen? And is it rare when they will change the location of a trial just because of they feel they can't get a jury of people who haven't heard enough about this case already, I guess. That would be one of the big ones, right?
So, Ray, do you want to – have you ever had a situation where moved to change venue, as they say?
Sure. It's easier moved than granted. So I think Judge Andrews can attest that any time there's a high-profile case, there's generally going to be at least an attempt to move a case out of a jurisdiction, particularly in smaller communities. But – it's seldom granted. In the 30-plus years I've been trying cases, I've had one case where venue was changed, and that was a high-profile murder case in Ketchikan. And before we could move it, the court tried to sit the jury in Ketchikan and could not do it. And after the fact, he moved it to Anchorage. So it's very rare, and surprisingly, I think Judge Andrews can probably add to this, it is shockingly surprising that you go to pick a jury in a case that you are very familiar with, that it may have even been in the paper every day and even on television, and it's surprising to see how many jurors really don't know much about the case. So at least that's been my experience. How about you, Judge?
I think that that's probably correct, and you do have to try and get the jury in the locale, and it's... So you make a concerted effort to do it, and if you can't do it, then you move it. But you do have to give it a try. And, of course, you know, there's a tremendous cost and inconvenience because the event occurred in the community. That means all of the witnesses, law enforcement, you know, sometimes the lawyers, everyone needs to go someplace else and be housed and remain there for a period of time. So there is a... You know, and that goes with the fact that, you know, there is a desire to have cases tried near to the communities in which they occur if they can get a fair jury. So let me ask Stacy and Ray, too, also can join in on this. You bring folks in off the PFD list because they're Alaska residents and they're 18 years old.
Right.
And they haven't asked to be excused, at least on paper, for any of the very small exceptions that we have to excuse mm-hmm. jurors. It used to be that even judges are not excused from jury service. So you it's not easy to get excused initially, but then you come into the jury room. What can a juror expect when they come to the jury assembly room? Are we just going to send them to a courtroom? Do they get instructions? What happens before Ray sees them in the courtroom?
No, it does vary quite a bit by court, but I can tell you from Anchorage, the jurors come into an assembly room. We have a clerk out there who gives them an orientation and shows them the jury video, and we like to have someone out there with the jurors all the time so they have a point of contact if they have any questions. From there, it depends on how many trials are going that particular day, but they're split up into groups and sent to the various courtrooms when the courtrooms are ready for them. They might fill out a questionnaire in the assembly room for the attorneys and the judge to look at.
And Ray, you're going to be on the receiving end when these jurors come to you. I have a whole list of questions for you, but maybe I'll start with a very general overview. You've been picking juries since you were admitted to the bar in 1982, and you've done it for a long time. Have you seen a change in the way in the system itself, and the efficiency of the system, and the depth of the system? Give us a little historical perspective on how things have changed over the last 30 or 40 years.
Sure, I'll try to make it as concise as possible, but it's changed. It's had an evolution of change significantly since the early 80s. we used to come into a courtroom with very little information about a juror, and our goal was to educate the jury or individual jurors about our case and ingratiate ourselves. And we ended up finding out very little about who the jury was or who the juror was. And over time, and during that time, you would each attorney would question one juror, and the other attorney would question the same juror, and it would go on and on, monotonous. And it wasn't very helpful to the attorneys, wasn't helpful to the court, and it took an inordinate amount of time. Now, it kind of evolved into the Phil Donahue approach, where we would voir dire the entire panel. And it was actually started by a lady named Kat Bennett. She was a humanistic psychologist. And we learned to go through the entire panel and try to get the panel to be a cohesive group and find out, have them expose themselves, let them know that there were no wrong answers, and that's still what we do to a large extent, and try to find out something about the jurors. And as a result, we've been able to get the courts to expand the use of jury questionnaires, because we've convinced, I think, most judges that questionnaires cut down the amount of time for jury selection. We've incorporated a lot of ideas from the psychological community in terms of neuropsychology, humanistic psychology. Now there's a subculture of juror selection experts. But all in all, the biggest change has been that we've learned to pick a cohesive group of jurors, not educate them about our case, but actually find out something about them. And what used to take 3 days now can take 1 day. And what used to take now most civil cases, regardless of the complexity, we get an hour apiece with the whole panel and find out a lot more information, because we have a lot more information going in.
You know, I'd like to just remind our listeners, if you've just tuned in, we are talking about serving on juries, what's it like, how are juries selected, and we're here on Justice Alaska with Stacey Warby, the State Court Jury Coordinator. Ray Brown is here, a longtime trial attorney who's had to select many juries. Of course, my co-host is Elaine Andrews, and if you'd like to participate, let me just put the numbers out there for you, 550-8433 in Anchorage. 1-888-353-5752 statewide, or we also welcome emails to hometown@alaskapublic.org. So if you've been on a jury and you've got questions, this is a great time to get them answered. So, but back to you, Elaine. Thank you.
So, Stacey, one of the things I know jurors find a little bit exasperating is that they get called and they show up in a jury assembly room in a courthouse somewhere in the state, and they may watch a jury film, and then they're twiddling their thumbs, and they're thinking, well, you called me here because you had a trial, and now I'm here, and where's the trial?
And I'm sitting.
And then maybe at, you know, an hour after they've been there, then they say, well, you can go for the day. And, you know, I mean, it's
what's going on?
What's
going
on?
That can be frustrating.
Yes, it's frustrating. So can what's happening that why did you call me if you didn't need me is, I think, the question the jurors have.
There's a lot of things going on in the courtroom that jurors aren't privy to, and that's by design, so they're not, they don't form opinions before they actually get into the courtroom. But even if you're not placed on a jury and you're just sitting in the assembly room waiting, you're really not wasting your time, because that can, the jury sitting in the assembly room has a way of motivating matters to resolve in the courtroom.
The pressure of the jury.
The pressure of the jury sitting there. And I think we're getting better. I know in Anchorage, if a jury isn't gone or has not gone up into the courtroom, the judges have been coming down and speaking to the jury and kind of explaining what's going on. So we've started a program in the last couple of years where we actually have a judge come down and speak with the jurors before they go into the courtroom, if they don't go into the courtroom. So at least they see a judge coming down to speak with them.
Right. And so, you know, from a judge's point of view, I mean, some of the things that might be happening in the courtroom that the jury isn't going to be participating in, there might be, a defendant or might be made a last minute offer in a plea
settlement.
Deal,
yeah,
and so they decide to take a plea, or the deal was already out there, but they didn't, something has happened from last night to this morning in terms of a witness or something else that changes the landscape. And so what was going to be trial because of a changing landscape now becomes a plea arrangement. And so the trial isn't, so a trial jury is not needed and the case is resolved. And it wouldn't resolve unless there was a jury there ready to try it. The other thing that might be happening is there might be some confusion, some last minute matters are discovered that should have been, the information should have been traded, and now it really changes the landscape of the trial, and things aren't ready to go. And I mean, the courts and the lawyers really try and avoid that, because when trial preparation is a huge effort, and nobody wants to be surprised at the last minute. So those don't happen very often, because there are a lot of procedures before a case is called for trial to prevent that from happening. So those are the kinds of things that, you know, might mean that a jury is either waiting or is dismissed because, as you say, their presence there made things happen. So
Do teachers have an easier time getting off juries than other people? I know I saw something going on in a jury selection where the judge kept asking this teacher about his situation. I think that it was right before finals or something like that, and so he kept kind of asking for,
right.
And I wondered if whether any profession has any. I mean, you said judges don't get off. So,
no, well, I mean it is a very. There are all kinds of difficult things to juggle in letting jurors go. I mean, I have had very difficult conversations with doctors who have, you know, patients that need to be seen, teachers who have students that need to be taught, single moms with two or three kids and lack of daycare for those kids. I mean, you have people at the very high end, people at the very low end, and then you have people whose profession will allow them to be paid their salary while they're serving jury, and others that it will be a huge financial burden for them. So, jurors are encouraged to tell the judge what their situation is, and then, you know, the judge can ask a lot of questions of the juror to determine if, and being excused from one jury, the judge may say, well, this is going to be a murder case that we think is going to take 3 weeks, and in your situation, 3 weeks might be unreasonable, but we can put you back in the jury pool for, you know, perhaps a DWI or some other kind of case that might take a day or two. So being excused from one jury may not mean that you get excused from jury service generally. So those are tough calls.
Mm-hmm. One thing people should remember is in most courts, you can choose to reschedule your jury service. So for a teacher maybe in an underperforming school, we would recommend they reschedule to the summertime. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and again, communicate with your local court. If you have any questions about your service or it's going to be a hardship, just call. Mm-hmm. And they're there to help you.
Who do you get if you call? What do you call? You call just Alaska State Court?
It depends on your court location. The larger locations, Anchorage, Palmer, Fairbanks, Juneau, have actual jury clerks. So you would call the jury clerk's office. Some of the smaller courts might have a clerk of court who does everything.
Jack of all trades.
Jack of all trades.
Yeah,
right. But there is someone at every court location responsible for jury. So they'll be knowledgeable and be able to help you.
So I'm going to ask Ray, in your experience picking juries, do you have a sense that people who are called to the box are anxious to be jurors, afraid to be jurors? What's your overall impression about
the gestalt of the juror?
Yes.
It's completely variable. Some people are scared to death, and it's up to the attorney to really calm the situation down, and the court, but mostly the attorney with the case, to calm that juror down and let them know it's okay to be afraid. It's okay to, you know, it's a first experience for most to open up about their personal life in front of strangers. So it's very important that, you know, you make those people feel comfortable. Then you have the other extreme, people that are really a little too anxious to get on a jury. And so those are actually more difficult, because those people you need to diffuse and, I guess, figure out why they are so anxious to be on the jury, and it takes a little bit of time to find why. I would much rather have the person afraid and unsure about being there than somebody that was terribly anxious to just to sit on, because there may be some underlying motivation.
Okay. And in terms of a juror having to reveal personal information in an open court, I think that, and you tell me if that's been your experience, Ray, that most judges will accommodate any juror who says, I'd like to answer that question, but I don't want to answer that in front of all these people. And so then what happens is you go into a separate room with the lawyers outside the presence of the rest of the jury and anyone else who might be in the courtroom, and a discussion takes place outside the presence of everybody else. Because has that been your experience?
It has. I mean, there are some things that are so personal that no one should have to bear the burden of exposing it to the general public or to anyone around you. So, yeah, I've never had a court refuse to allow someone that has a situation like that go outside and discuss it in private.
So it's not on the record?
Well, it's on the...
It will be recorded. Yeah,
it will be recorded,
but it won't be broadcast in the courtroom.
Okay.
So that if, for example, if a person says, you know, I don't know, whatever they want to say, then one lawyer might want to keep the juror and another lawyer might want to get rid of the juror. And the only way to determine what's happening and to have it reviewed by a higher court would be to have it recorded. So it is recorded, but it's not...
that's what I thought.
It's not broadcast.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks.
Right.
That's helpful. Yeah.
Right. So I'm going to ask Ray. You come in and you've now done your Phil Donahue, and you have a sense of the...
Hello?
Yes. Are you there? Have we lost you? Ray?
Oh. Hi, Ray.
Oh. Ray, are you there? Well, we seem to have lost him for the moment.
We're just going to take a quick little break. I'm Kathleen McCoy. I think you're listening to Hometown Alaska. I hope he's...
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. We're talking about jury service, and I would just encourage people who've been on juries and what they thought about that experience. We'd love to hear from you, or if you have questions about how the process works, or how you know, defense attorneys and prosecutors decide. Those are some of the things we're going to be talking about. We have Stacey Warby, the state court jury coordinator, here in the studio with us, and also in the studio is Elaine Andrews, a judge who knows all about juries and jury selection. And then we have Ray Brown with us, actually on the phone. And we lost you briefly there, Ray, but we're so glad to have you back. Longtime trial attorney.
Sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay. So let's see, where were you had just posed an interesting question.
Well,
so go ahead.
My question was, you know, the jury is now seated and you've gone through your first bevy of questions, and there are jurors that you may not want there, but no one has given you an answer that you can really challenge. You're just not pleased with every single thing you've heard or seen. So what's your ability to remove jurors, and why would you remove them? And maybe you could talk about the two different ways that you could do that.
Sure. There, the two ways are governed by court rule. There's a peremptory challenge. In a civil case, it's 3 per side. Generally, there's some exceptions to that. There's an extra one added for alternate jurors. And then there's challenge for cause. And so if it's what we try to do because of the limitation, and in criminal cases, the challenges are different, and there's more. I can talk about that in a minute. But generally what we try to do is to get jurors for cause, that is to demonstrate some reason that they could not be fair. And there's a whole list of questions. I don't want to go over them and take up everyone's time, but there's different ways that we can challenge jurors for cause without using one of our discretionary peremptory challenges. But generally, you only have 3. So in a complicated case, most of the cases I do now are medical malpractice, but in a complicated case, you only have 3. And if once those are gone, you can't challenge any more of the jurors. So it's we really try to use the challenge for cause, but it is very difficult at times to get a juror for cause. I'll be glad to talk about that if you want me to take the time.
Well, a challenge for cause, I mean, can you why would you say to a judge there is cause to remove this juror? What kind of answer could they give that would make you say to the judge, who has the ultimate decision, judge, please remove this person for cause? They can't be a fair juror. What kinds of things come up in that realm?
Well, what usually happens is you'll have a juror that will answer questions like, let me give you an example in a medical malpractice case. They would say, I just think that there are too many lawsuits, and I think I just don't think that judges are. I don't think that doctors should be sued. And then you'll start going into questions, and you always ask leading questions, and you do it in front of all the other jurors, but not in a way to intimidate the other jurors. So it's careful to not be truthful when you get to them, but you ask them leading questions to isolate their opinions, to say, you know, this is what you've said, you believe that doctors are infallible, this is a medical malpractice case, it'd be very difficult for you to be fair and unbiased. And those are some rough quick examples. And then what generally happens is the judge steps in and tries to rehabilitate the juror by saying, yes, but I'm going to give you instructions, and if I tell you that you have to follow the law and you have to listen to all the witnesses and follow the credibility of witness instruction, and they try to rehabilitate the juror. But it generally, you need to show that the witness can't, as a general sense, that the witness can't be fair. They've formulated opinions that they cannot set aside. There are other reasons for cause. If they know people in the case that are principals, like parties, or they know someone personal that's going to be a witness. I mean, there's a lot of other reasons, but they're articulated or listed actually in the court rule. But it's a difficult process to actually get someone challenged for cause, because the court does everything possible to keep as many jurors in the courtroom as possible.
And then if you don't have them excused for cause, then you do have, at least in the cases that you're trying, 3 opportunities just to excuse someone for no cause at all, just simply because
gut
feeling.
That's
right. But it's a balancing act in doing that, because when you go after a juror for cause, you have to use one of your preempts if you lose that, if you go after the cause, because you have to sometimes be aggressive to expose the bias or prejudice or lack of the fact that you could not possibly leave this person on the jury that you're trying. And so once you go through that process, you're going to lose one of your peremptory challenges, because you can't leave that person on the jury.
Okay.
Well, you can, but it would not be wise.
Okay. Do you ever, and did you ever, and has this practice changed, at the end of a trial, when the verdict has come in and the trial is over, do you ever talk to jurors personally, or have someone from your office talk to jurors? Is that something that young lawyers do and more experienced lawyers don't? What about jurors post-trial?
Well, my philosophy on jurors post-trial is and always has been that I don't talk to jurors unless they ask to talk to me. And the reason for that is that the collective wisdom of 12 jurors, in my experience, is the best wisdom of all. And even though they explain why they did something, I'm not sure it's completely accurate. So it hasn't been helpful to me. But I have friends that I respect greatly that always interview jurors post-trial. Howard Lazar, a very experienced lawyer here in Anchorage, always interviews jurors post-trial and believes that it's constructive. So I think it depends on the individual attorney, and it makes me very nervous, bottom line, because win or lose, sometimes it scares me that the jury came to the verdict or the decision that they did, and so I would rather think it was just because of my skillful lawyering.
Right. Let me throw out our phone numbers just one more time for folks, and then we'll continue with that. In Anchorage, it's 550-8433. Statewide, 1-888-353-5752, or email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. I'm very interested in the psychology of reading a jury, or, basically what lawyers are doing is telling their story in the most persuasive way they can, and there's two stories going on in the courtroom. So I'm just very interested in the reading of the jury and how that makes you decide how to attack a case. And I know there's a million different kinds of cases, so it's hard to talk about. But I'm just, it seems very human, I guess, having a jury. So could you talk a little bit about that, Ray?
Sure. I mean, it's really gotten very, it depends on who you talk to, but it's really gotten down into the neurosciences and, like as I said a minute ago, psychological issues, but humanistic psychology issues, and there's a lot of publications on it, and there's a sub-industry of jury consultants, as I indicated. But generally, it's totally case-specific. Because every juror comes in with preconceived notions and biases. So what we have learned and what I've learned over the years is that it's not so important. I mean, everybody's got a bias. What's important, the dangerous juror is the juror that doesn't open up and that doesn't talk to you and that doesn't admit to things that you know to be true. Now, I gave you an example a minute ago. We have jury questionnaires that we've, in complicated cases, that give us a bunch of information going in. But we also have Facebook, Twitter, all of these accounts that we can, and public records in the courthouse. So going in, we know a lot about jurors already that we didn't used to know. And so we leave jurors on who may have a bias against us or may have a bias for us. I mean, that it's really not the central core issue anymore. I used to not like to leave teachers on juries, certain juries, and I don't want to go into why. But I've abandoned all of those approaches. Now, the more information that I can obtain from a juror, the more that I can have those jurors expose themselves and other people on the jury panel, the more I put together what I think, at least, is going to be a cohesive group of decision makers. We generally know who's going to be the foreman. We can figure that out because of our experience and the answers to the questions. And there's some great publications out there. One of my favorites is called 12 Heroes and One Voice. It's a meditation, really, on picking jurors and figuring out by the time the panel is sworn in if that jury is going to be cohesive and what their decision-making process is likely to be and who the leader is going to be and who the followers are going to be. Interesting, actually.
We have one question, so may I just go ahead and we've got a call from Byron and Willow who wants to talk about jury selection. Welcome to Justice Alaska, Byron.
Hi, how you doing?
We're great. What's your question?
Well, I just don't think you should hand select a jury, so I guess that's not a question, that's a thought. But it seems like you're selecting like a lynch mob. And my question is why aren't criminals, which are also our peers, allowed on a jury?
So two questions, I guess. Ray, how about you? Want to jump in on that?
Sure. Because I mean, I've been a criminal defense lawyer and a prosecutor. So it's an interesting question, Byron. One of the problems is that there's state laws that prohibit convicted felons, for instance, for being on a jury until their civil rights have been restored. I think misdemeanors can certainly sit on juries as long as they don't have there's no active case pending against the prosecuting authority. You can certainly sit on a civil jury if you have a misdemeanor conviction. But they're really not. I'm sorry that he has that conception that they're lynch mobs. They're really not. And well-picked juries in criminal cases, they're all fact-driven, but well-picked juries in criminal cases generally serve both the public and the defendant well. So I hope that answers the question, but I don't think that if you've been a victim of a crime, for instance, you wouldn't want to have if you've been a victim of a burglary, you wouldn't want to have 12 people convicted of burglary sitting on the jury, probably, and the prosecutor would never leave them on. But regardless of your thoughts, the statutes dictate who can and can't serve on a jury, so it's not the individual lawyers picking it.
And my experience has been that really jurors take their jobs very, very seriously, even in cases that are not, legally speaking, the most serious of cases. They're misdemeanors, and they have a maximum penalty of a year in jail. But the jurors really take their jobs seriously. And my experience has been, and maybe they're just blowing smoke at me, but at the end of their jury service, when I talk to them, they just say it was so interesting. It was so fascinating. I was reluctant to serve. I didn't want to serve. I didn't want to take the time. I thought it would be a waste of time. I was afraid to serve. And almost to a person, really, over more than 20 years, the jurors have said, really glad I did this. And even the most cynical have said it actually gives me confidence in the carefulness of the justice system, which is not to say the juries don't make mistakes, but it's that has been, in my experience, what most of them have said,
right.
even if it was difficult.
To Byron's point, I mean, even if a prosecutor was trying to get a lynch mob on the jury, the defense attorney's trying to get the opposite. I mean,
That's right.
And so there's no one intention there at all. So, and actually, to this question of jury experience, we've got another caller. I'd like to welcome Sid on the line from Anchorage. Hi, Sid.
Hello.
And you served on a jury, and you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes, because it was very different from my experience other places, and I'm very old. I've been on juries in various places.
Okay, congratulations. You're still with us.
Yeah, and I don't take medicine for anything, which I'm not complaining about.
So your experience in Anchorage was different than other places? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I also think it was different from Anchorage 30 years ago. But and this was a very famous person being on trial for murder. An old cold case had finally resurrected itself. And they picked a jury pool of like 300 jurors to pick 15 jurors and alternates from. That's a lot of jurors. It took weeks to go through the process of selection. And part of the process was they exposed us to the material that was going to be at trial to make sure you wouldn't get sick or something, because it was pretty, horror movie-type material. And usually it's not very hard to get off a jury in other parts of the world. If you arrest people because you're, run a store and you have to do that as part of your job, or if you're a policeman, or if you're all sorts of people at various jobs, this jury, they were taking police officers, they were taking ex-convicts. It provided that you didn't have a direct connection to the case, that lawyers got to get rid of you, but that you were not just dismissed automatically for all the causes that would normally let you off of a jury in other parts of the country.
Mm.
And also the judge was quite adamant, you don't serve, I'm going to tell the PFD people that you don't are ineligible for PFDs anymore, because you're not. We think we've paid for your time.
What
and,
year was this? What years
it was a
this?
Very different experience than I was used to having.
Uh-huh.
And But I was incredibly impressed, but more than I expected to be. I've been around courts and legal proceedings from various capacities for a long time, and I didn't expect to be extremely impressed. But the lawyers on both sides and the judge were absolutely, they belonged in a movie telling you how it should be done. They were explaining to the jurors the principles of law. They were inspiring to hear if you're a person who understands the way things should be. But normally when I get exposed to the court system here, I had a judge say once, I had 150 cases this morning. I have another 150 this afternoon. I've had time to read none of the briefs. My impression is that it's really, really cookie cutter, and nobody's taking the time to do anything right. But when it's a really high-profile murder case, it's the opposite of that. Everybody takes the time to make sure everybody knows what is happening and why it's supposed to happen that way and why a juror really matters.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I was very impressed with the procedural way the court went through the jury process, selection process, which took, as I recall, 2 weeks before. Gotten down to there were 16 people left in the pool, and they needed 15.
Oh, wow.
And I was by then resigned to the fact I'm going to be stuck for months on this jury. And I had the chief prosecutor said, is there any question that I asked any other juror that you think might apply to you? And I said, well, I noticed you got rid of all the experts in anything related to this case, and one of the subjects that matters is electronics, as computers. I'm a computer engineer, I'm a pioneer, and I might be considered to be an expert. And if you're getting rid of all the experts, maybe you need to get rid of me too. And so then both sides asked me all sorts of questions like, suppose we put an expert witness on, and he says something that you disagree with. What would you do? And I said, well, first of all, the chances are, if he said something, I'm going to agree with him. But if I didn't, what he said under oath with the possibility of cross-examination by the other side is evidence. What I think in my mind that nobody ever got to cross-examine is not evidence to apply to this case. I can't be selling this in my own in the jury room because I think that that's technical error. And the prosecutor said, I'm impressed. But he still got rid of me.
Oh.
He said, I don't think you could do it. But he says, the idea that you really believe, that you really believe you could segregate your opinion from the expert opinion and rule on the expert's position is impressive.
Well, thanks. I mean, that's actually an interesting juror-related view of things. If I can just maybe segue to ask Ray, this person who was almost a juror and sounds like he would have been a terrific one, talks about an alternate. Ray, can you tell us what an alternate juror is?
Sure. In a case like that, there were probably three, and so it would have been a total of 15. But generally, in all of the all superior court cases, that's cases over 100,000, I think, is the jurisdictional level minimum, and then in all felonies in Superior Court, there are 12 jurors. However, almost always there's at least one and usually two alternates that are selected in the event that one of the jurors that is sitting in the trial gets sick or for some reason can no longer function as a juror. And so one of those alternate jurors is generally selected at random. It's usually a drawing. So you pick the two jurors, but depending on whose courtroom you're in, you really don't know which alternate's going to be selected. And frankly, I've had numerous trials where the alternates had to be seated. So it's they have to listen to everything as if they're going to be on the deliberative body once the case goes to the jury.
And let me ask, is there something that, I mean, jurors can only make decisions on what they hear, just as our caller was really so eloquently stated. But you and I talked earlier about a situation in which the jurors did not follow the judge's directions and actually kind of caused a significant problem to happen. Do you have just a minute or so to devote to tell us that story?
Sure. Yeah, I've only had, let me first of all say that juries almost always do the right thing for the right reason. So I believe wholeheartedly in the jury process. But I've had one jury in all the years I've been practicing. It was a first-degree murder case where the jury, this was in the time when we used to sequester juries in high-profile cases. The jury was sequestered and given specific instructions not to do two things. One, never break sequestration. That is, they had to stay together in the presence of a jury clerk, a bailiff, and except at night, of course, when they're in their hotel rooms. And two, they couldn't consume alcohol during deliberation. And on both counts, they failed. They broke sequestration, got away from the bailiff. They conducted some experiments. They consumed alcohol, had alcohol in their room, and then under oath denied that they had done that. And they convicted after 3.5 days. They convicted this young man. And then 6 or 5 of the 12 jurors came to me 48 hours later and wanted to change their verdict and disclose this. And the trial court found it very troubling, but upheld the verdict. But it was ultimately reversed at the Supreme Court. So it was a 5-week murder trial that cost the state a lot of money, cost the defendant a lot of money, and ended up being set aside. So it happens, but not very often.
Okay, and the jurors are given instructions at the end of a case. They're not just told, go do justice. I mean, they'll
make a decision.
Right, right. And what role do you as a lawyer play in those jury instructions? I mean, do you have a part in that?
I hope. Huge. We generally try to formulate jury instructions early on in a case so that we'll know the likelihood of what the jury is going to be told and how the jury is supposed to evaluate the evidence. So jury instructions are of utmost importance. And I think the caller that just called in really underscores what a good juror is, and that they actually, I've just found it incredibly impressive and amazing that they read the instructions, they follow the instructions almost always. And though the instructions are pivotal, always, in making a decision on a case. So yeah, we do a lot of work on jury instructions and try obviously to persuade the court to accept the instructions that we submit. But it's ultimately up to the court and Judge Andrews in her court or any judge in their court to determine which instructions are going to be given.
Okay, and so when one of the things that jurors always want to ask about is, evidence, admissible evidence, inadmissible evidence, and maybe you can explain what gets in front of a jury and what doesn't get in front of a jury and why. I mean, in a very general kind of way.
Well, in general, let me just say that all experienced practitioners, good trial lawyers, generally work out long in advance of a trial what evidentiary issues are going to be problematic and what issues need to be filed in formal motions with the court to avoid having the jury sent out evidentiary issues are being disputed. But generally, all relevant evidence is admissible. As long as it's relevant. And if there is some evidence, however, that may be relevant, but its probative value, that is, the value of the evidence itself, is so far outweighed by its prejudicial impact that the court excludes it. There's other types of evidence that is very interesting, prior bad act evidence, in other words, evidence where somebody has done similar things in the past, that the other side wants to introduce to show that it's likely that they had a propensity to commit the same act again. Well, that type of evidence can come in, but not to show propensity. Can show it can have other probative value, but there may the fact that it comes in may be so prejudicial under any reason to get it in that the court's not going to allow it. So we try. I think Judge Andrews can probably speak to this. The worst thing that we can do as lawyers is have juries sitting in the jury room for an hour out of a five-hour day while sensitive evidentiary issues are debated in front of the court. So good trial lawyers try to foresee all the evidentiary cases, anything that's going to be debatable as to whether it's coming in or not, or the jury's going to hear, and get those issues worked out so the jury doesn't have to wonder why a piece of evidence was objected to and they didn't get to hear it.
I would agree that that's those things are, we really, really try and get those all lined out, and things do occur mid-trial, but even when that happens, then we try and just maybe move on to another witness and finish off the jury day, and then the judge and the lawyers stay after the jury's been excused, and you work it out for the next day. Yes, I often think of a trial as a roller coaster. I mean, once it starts,
you can't get off till the ride's over.
You can't get off till the ride's over, and everyone is working incredibly hard to maximize the efficiency for the use of the jury. So they're generally there in Anchorage 5 hours. The trial day runs usually 8:30 to 1:30 with the afternoon reserved for afternoon matters. And so, the jury may leave and the lawyers and the judge may be there until 4 or 5 or 6 o'clock at night working out the procedures for the next day. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the lawyers will go home and prepare their witnesses and
stay
be up until
night
stay
working.
Up all night working and come back the next morning.
You know what surprises me, that Ray said that you can tell who the foreman is going to be just from the way people behave or maybe their past experience, what they've done. I'm just amazed at that. I guess having sat in prospective jury boxes and looked around and wondered, I wonder who would be the... And you guys are already tuned in. You've got your antenna up. Can you talk about anything about that, or even just things that are automatic concerns for you? That and again, every case is different, so every jury is different, and what you're worried about is different. But the psychology or what you're listening for is just fascinating to me. So I don't know, Ray. Can you contribute to anything there? We only have about not a whole lot of time. So maybe about a minute.
It's so difficult to explain in a short period of time. But it depends on the case. But if you know who the dominant person's going to be, or the controlling person, the strength in a jury, in a particular juror veneer, and pick out who that foreman's going to be, it's so fact-driven about your case. I mean, and it has nothing to do with gender. The strongest person can be, and oftentimes is, a woman on the jury. And it can be a man, obviously, but if that person has characteristics that you've voir dired and discovered that are not going to be helpful for your case, then that's a person, and we make these decisions while we're picking the jury. If we believe that person's likely to be the foreman of the panel that's sitting
Ray.
In the box...
we have run out of time. Can you hear the music on your end? We have to thank you so much. I'm sorry to have to cut you off, and I really appreciate that. I was really interested in what you're saying, but I got to say thank you. I'd like to say thanks to Judge Andrews, to Stacey Warby, the coordinator for the Alaska State Court System for Juries, and Ray Brown out there in California somewhere. Thank you so much. And, of course, our listeners and callers. Charles Warforth and I will co-host next week's Hometown Alaska, when we share news of a milestone here at KSKA's Radio History. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska.
Responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.